So that was a great beginning of the conference, and latent in the interview are many of the themes that we want to be exploring today. Perhaps the most prominent we're not going to focus on in this particular session, the most prominent being the quantum leap in opportunities for creativity created by new technologies and the way new forms of art, new practices of and conceptions of music in particular, which we're going to see also, at least as importantly, film, are taking off on those new technologies and challenging the legal system. All right, that's a big theme, and we will get to it in due course, but that's not the primary focus of this session. The primary focus of this session is a broader one. What is creativity? What is it inherently, or what has it been in different cultures at different times? The aspect of creativity that's most challenging concerns cumulative or sequential innovation, the extent to which one person may, should draw upon other people's work. This concern finds expression in the legal system. Some of the mechanisms by which the law tries to address this issue have already been mentioned in the course of the questions. So in the American legal system, there's a distinction between ideas and expression in copyright law. The creator of something is able to shield against other people, to protect it as a monopoly, his or her expression, the particular way in which he or she captures the work, but not the idea behind it. Right? That much contested, much litigated boundary is one of the ways in which the legal system tries to get at creativity. And another is the fair use doctrine, which has come up twice already in the American legal system, less so in other legal systems. This is a device to enable people who have encroached upon the copyrights of others sometimes to escape liability on the grounds that on balance their cumulative work should be deemed fair and excusable thereby. But at least as important, as also the interview just suggested, at least as important as the nuances of those legal rules is the cultural standards, the expectations, the sense of decency and fairness that guides our conducts independent of the law. What do we celebrate? What do we respect? What do we treat as plagiarism? And what do we treat as new? What do we fire people for rather than bring lawsuits against them? Those are cultural standards that are related to, but not at all the same thing, the legal ones. All right, so those are some of the concerns I hope we get at here. And we're going to do it in modified traditional format. So a traditional format in conferences, you have panelists to each present papers. Each takes longer than their allotted time, and leaving a few minutes at the end for questions, and they rarely speak to each other. So we're going to try to deviate from that. We do have four very distinguished panelists, but we're going to ask them to each speak more briefly and more extemporaneously than is usually the case, and to have them talk to each other or address each other's issues, and to fold in your comments and questions as we go along. So we'll start with Bill Alford. My colleague here teaches a striking array of courses here at Harvard Law School, international trade central among them. He's the head of the East Asian Legal Studies Program, deeply immersed in Chinese literature, history, and law. Also head of the graduate program here. Some years ago, he spent a great deal of time studying intellectual property practices and law in China, and wrote the definitive book on the subject, which has the intriguing title, To steal a book is an elegant offense. So I thought we'd start with an odd place, far from the United States and far from our contemporary culture, and ask Bill to speak to what did creativity mean in China?
Great. So thanks, Terry. Thanks very much, all of you. And it's great to have this kind of format. We're putting together creative people and those in the academic world who may be creative in other ways, and especially inspired by Mike Dowdy's talk about the 8 different ways of voicing the word end. I'd love to do that in my class, you know, retakes while we're teaching. So Terry asked me to come to talk about this, some of the ideas in this book I wrote a long time ago. It was actually meant as a compliment. To steal a book is an elegant offense. It's an old Chinese saying, in effect, arguing that knowledge is not exclusive to one person. In that and in the few comments I'll make by way of introduction, I clearly don't mean to suggest that there's a lack of energy, creativity, originality, or that people approached it in a uniform way throughout Chinese history. I mean, we're dealing with one of the world's greatest, richest, longest civilizations. So it's rather to kind of suggest ideas of, as Terry suggested, sequential creation, how IP relates to it, and so forth. So without being reductionist, I want to start with a quote from Confucius, who said 2,500 years ago in the Analects, "The master," that's Confucius, said, "I transmit rather than create. I believe in and love the ancients." So the idea here is to suggest the power of the past and just how central and important it is in constituting ourselves and thinking of us as individuals, our relationships of the state. The past was not something that was remote and distant and dusty and, you know, sort of antiquarian. It was meant to be alive. It was meant in Chinese society that historically did not have organized religion in the way that we think of the post-Enlightenment West, did not have a formal constitution in the way that we think of our own society. The past really provided a yardstick, a basis, a metric for gauging our own behavior, for gauging the way that we interacted with others, for assessing how the ruler did or didn't do. I'd be glad to elaborate later if people are interested, but for example, there's this notion of what's called Zhengming, or rectification of names. Is the ruler really acting like a ruler ought to act? How would we know? Well, we look to the past, to the great, to be sure, idealized rulers of the past. Or as one of my colleagues elsewhere at Harvard who does Chinese literature put it, the experience of the past roughly corresponds to and carries the same force as the attention to meaning or truth in the Western tradition. So with this vision of the past, again, as something live and vibrant that we need to engage with to define ourselves, to assess our relationships, to assess the state, there were very important conceptions related to the arts. Again, I'm compressing a lot of history here, but in the traditional Chinese setting, there was less of a kind of romantic image that we have in the post-Enlightenment West of the solitary genius sitting there alone, kind of coming up with the inspiration on his or her own and making a quantum leap. Much more, there was a sense in the arts that we all build on a foundation of knowledge from the past, of shared understanding, of shared symbols and metaphors, and that we make our mark not so much by breaking with it, you know, the solitary person under the apple tree with the new inspiration, and much more by the ways in which we manipulate the terms and symbols of the past, show our understanding of them, but as we do that, add our own touch. Again, not to diminish one of the world's most creative and wonderful civilizations, but how do we play with the shared vocabulary? How do we use it to show our own touch? And so, as Wen Fong, who is the curator of Chinese arts at the Met in New York, put it, copying didn't carry with it the same dark connotations that we think it has in the contemporary West. In effect, as a very famous Chinese political and artistic figure of the 11th century named Wang Anshu said, if the very characters we use to write, Chinese characters are, you know, are ideographs or symbols, if the very characters come from nature, right, weren't really created by man, but are kind of copied from nature, it is rather nervy of us to think that one of us can then claim individual proprietary interest in it. Those weren't his words, but that was sort of the thrust of it. And that's reflected in the law in late imperial through late imperial China, and I think leaves a deep kind of cultural residue. Now, this isn't to excuse sort of whatever goes on or doesn't go on with IP in China. I was delighted when Eric Priest, who's in the room, came back from a trip to Beijing a couple of weeks ago. And he said, "Professor Alford, somebody has taken your book and actually steal the book is an elegant offense and actually copied large parts of it into their book and published it without any attribution, and that person's the professor of intellectual property at Beijing University, which is China's most famous." So I went home and told my wife, who's from China, and she said, "There's a website we should go to where we can list this guy, you know, as somebody who's a bad person." I said, "No, I'm thrilled that he did it. It kind of vindicates the project." So we're still talking this out at home, right? Anyway, just quick concluding comment, because Terry wanted us to be brief. So again, this isn't, you know, wholly explanatory of approaches toward IP in China over time. That it would be silly to be so reductionist. There are other things quickly to mention that are important. I mean, when ideas of modern IP, intellectual property, are introduced to China, they're introduced at gunpoint a century ago as the Chinese are really coerced into unequal treaties by the Brits, the U.S., and others. And there's some marvelous stories I'd be delighted to share later if there's time. Obviously, communism left its imprint. There were some wonderful things in the days when China was still a communist country. People would say, "Gee, we don't let iron workers put their names on steel girders. Why do we worry about authors putting their names on books?" Clearly, the fact that China is a developing country is of consequence. Think back to U.S. history a century ago. Dickens, Trollope, and many others were less than thrilled by U.S. approaches toward IP when we were a developing country. Think of China's immediate needs today, dealing with an AIDS epidemic that's barely acknowledged but massive. And so on. So anyway, that's just a quick set of introductory remarks, and I look forward to the discussion.
Fabulous. Okay. So next I'm going to ask Paul Hoffert to speak. So Paul knows about these issues from an amazing variety of angles. Paul is a technological creator, a scholar, and an artist in many genres. The last is probably the most important and relevant maybe for our purposes. He's a jazz recording artist, a television performer, an off-Broadway musical author, a film composer, recently inducted into the Canadian Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. So he's plainly been a participant at a high level in many of the sectors of culture we're concerned with here, and now teaches about it. He's a fine arts professor at York University in Toronto, and then serves in a variety of academic and supervisory capacities, chair of the Bell Broadcast and New Media Fund, chair of the Guild of Canadian Film and Television Composers, many more organizations. So, Paul, you could, given these qualifications, come at these issues from any of a variety of angles. Here would be one possibility. Does the bill's quick summary of conceptions of creativity in ancient China, some degree preserved through the present, resonate, or does it seem anomalous? Do you sense a dramatic divide, as might have been suggested by Bill when he referred to the romantic conception of creativity between the West and the East in this regard? Or are the conceptions of creativity that have informed and continue to inform Western culture, are they more cousins of the conceptions that Bill begins with?
Well, I think both, as usual, being an academic. I think when I think of some examples that I've come across from my own life, which is I self-identify as a creator. I've been a professional, some kind of creator, since I was 16 when I had my first album released, and then toured with a rock and roll band and wrote film scores, all the kind of stuff that Terry was talking about. Then I became an author and wrote computer programs. And I've earned a living from the fruits of my creation of intellectual property. All of the other things that I have done and that that you can read in my my brief bio, et cetera, being a university professor, coming to this conference and so on, I consider as hobby sort of avocation things that have been enabled, because I can create stuff and I've been able to pay my rent. So when I look back historically, I guess I would go back probably 20 or 30,000 years to the cave paintings in Lascaux, France, and the associated examples we have of the creation of arts in prehistoric times in Europe, and there are many, many. And there are a couple of things that always strike me about, aside from the incredible beauty and the incredible universality of some of the images that we see. One of them is that even though a lot of the images are created by artists in different locations in Europe, and hence, since they likely didn't have a lot of communication with each other, independent work, there are a lot of commonalities that you see in the paintings, a lot of common themes. Another thing that strikes me always, being a professional, is that many of the paintings, which are maybe 8 feet long and, you know, 5 or 6 feet high, clearly took long periods of time to do. Historians agree that pretty well these are art galleries that were created by the persons who and the communities who did them, the exact purposes for which we don't know, maybe we won't ever know, but they took a long time. And in those prehistoric times, basically every day you had to go out and either gather or hunt for food or you died. So the months and years that were spent creating these things were periods of time that the artists didn't hunt or gather food, and presumably their communities hunted and gathered food on their behalf and supported them. So that there was some kind of community framework, some might push it and say a socialist model of support for the creators in those times. Fast forward to maybe 5,000 years ago, when we start having evidence of certainly visual art in Egypt, but in North America, to bring it a little closer to home, we have the Inuit who have things like songs that we know were sung, basically creations, whether it's in literature or music or any of these things, are stories. Basically, people are storytellers. And if you look at the Inuit, their concept of ownership, as I understand it from the readings that I've done, was that there was a great proprietary sense of ownership and continues to be. And if somebody wrote a song about their stories and experiences, that nobody else would even think of singing that song because it was the property and the experiences of the person who did it. And if you go to another First Nations example, for example, the West Coast Indians, the Kwakiutl, say, on the West Coast of Canada, who had totem poles, and those stories were also proprietary, not necessarily to a person, but certainly to a tribe, and nobody would think of appropriating them, taking them, copying them, or perhaps even sharing them, because although they might not have had a concept of ownership of the land, they actually had a very strong concept of ownership of that kind of property. Fast forward again to Europe in the time of perhaps Shakespeare and around what Terry was speaking about, the printing press and so on and so forth. And certainly by the time Shakespeare was writing his plays, there was a sense of proprietary ownership. It was very important about the paternity. People always argued, you know, was Shakespeare all written by Shakespeare or by somebody else, Marlowe, etc. Anyway, this idea began to be coupled with a commercial sense, which is quite a different idea of making money. So Shakespeare, you know, wrote his plays, but then people would throw coins and there would be some patronage from the queen, perhaps. And the combination of patronage and audiences paying for what they got has survived to this day as some kind of an economic model in the West, which was only short-circuited rather briefly in a historic sense by the Soviet Union and the idea of communism, under which artists had a different support mechanism, which was basically get paid, you get identified as a creator, you get paid to create, and then And there's no direct relationship between the individual works that you then create and getting a payment for those individual works because they belong collectively to the community. Perhaps going back more to that Lascaux cave community model. So what does all of this mean? Well, as I think Mike demonstrated earlier very, very well, underlying most creative works that human beings enjoy are these kind of gestalts or simple little frameworks that are universally understood in all cultures. His example in music was three chords. You would call them a dominant, a subdominant, and so forth. In literature, the example going back to Shakespeare is, one of the basic models that's the same as those three chords is boy meets girl, they fall in love, there's a potential problem, it's not resolved and ends in a tragedy. Okay, Romeo and Juliet. So Shakespeare takes the three-chord model, puts his story around it, becomes Romeo and Juliet. Leonard Bernstein basically takes the model, and with a librettist you have West Side Story. Same basically underlying structure. So no matter whether it's visual art or literature or music, we have this idea that in the stories that are the creations of art, there are parts which we take from others and which are part of the human genome, I guess, because they're cross-cultural. Everybody, all societies, whether it was Ulysses writing about things or natives in pre-literate societies. But the stories tend to be the same kind of things. The songs all are generally what musicians call tonal. They come from scales that have maybe 5 tones or 7 tones or, in the last 100 years, 12 tones or a couple of 100 years. But these are all like similar things. My own experiences are, perhaps I'll share some with you and you may find them interesting. The rock and roll band that I founded and played in the 70s, which had a lot of hit records and stuff, and whose recordings are now reissued, about 6 years ago, somebody said, somebody sampled one of the Lighthouse tunes, and it's out in Europe, and what do you think about it? So I went online, and I got a copy of it, and at first I was flattered and really happy. Why was I flattered and happy? I shouldn't admit this, but I do admit this. And I went to my colleagues, and I said, listen, nowadays we're a bunch of old guys, and if somebody doesn't sample your music, it's kind of like, it's not a good thing. Like, you want to be important enough that somebody thinks that it's valuable to sample your music. And then we said, okay, but really they should have asked, and we would have given them permission. And it went by anyway. By the time we tried to find the people, it was the hit had come and gone in Europe, and it didn't matter. But then last year, I'll contrast that. I'm going to give you two bookend experiences. So one experience where people appropriated or used the sample of some of the music that I co-created. And at the end of the situation, I kind of felt that I was ripped off because they basically took a very identifiable, and Mike mentioned this, an identifiable section of the music. Last year, we got a call from a record label in Los Angeles that was specializes in urban music and rap stuff. And the label said that one of their artists had sampled a song that my company publishes. Now, the history of the song is interesting to the example. Lighthouse, when we released most of our records in the 70s, released a single called I'd Be So Happy. It was not a hit record. It was in the industry, they call it a stiff. But Three Dog Night, which was another contemporary band of ours, released the same song, I'd Be So Happy, performed by Three Dog Night. They didn't write it. They performed it. They had a hit on it. It remains as one of the songs on the Best of the Three Dog Night album. And the rap artist in Los Angeles sampled the Three Dog Night version of the song that my company owns the publishing to because it was originally written by myself and my co-writer. So they said they want to do this, and would we make a deal? And we said, sure, make us an offer. Anyway, they sent us an offer, and they were kind enough to include the new rap song, the original recording that it was sampled from. I listened to the song with my wife, who actually manages the publishing companies, and we said, that's a great tune, it's really good, but like, I don't hear any of I'd Be So Happy in this thing. So I'm like, it's great that they want to license it and that we can do it. So we went back, we listened to the Three Dog Night version, and of course what they did is they took a two-bar phrase in between the verse and the chorus, if you follow me, that was just an instrumental two chords from the Three Dog Night recording, sampled that and repeated it throughout the whole song. So the underlying music of the rap was two bars that contained none of the lyrics of I'd Be So Happy and none of the melody of I'd Be So Happy. The two things that I had learned in my career are the things that are copyrightable and that the law recognizes as proprietary, that I own in my publishing. What they sampled, I thought, they needn't have come to me, because I don't think that they would necessarily be breaking my copyrights by using two chords, which were actually not even in the original Lighthouse recording. They were just a little two-chord refrain that the other band put in. Anyway, basically, you know, they offered 30% of the ownership of the new song plus an advance, and we said, okay, we want 50%. We settled on 35%. We did the deal. Now, Warner Brothers, who own the master recording of I'd Be So Happy, of course, they had a much stronger claim because they were actually sampling significant part, a couple of bars of their sound recording. Anyway, my company owns 35% of this. Do I feel slightly guilty about that? Well, it's hard to feel guilty when you have to make a living out of business is business. There's not a lot of guilt in business. But as an artist, would I have felt bad if I heard that song in the sample? I would have agreed probably with Mike that it wouldn't have bothered me, and I wouldn't have, neither would I have gone after those folks legally, but I wouldn't have felt that it was misappropriated. So those are a couple of examples, and I won't go too far, but perhaps a quote did come to mind about copyright from writer Mark Twain, and I will probably misquote it, and I'm sure that the lawyers and everybody here will know the original. But as I recall, Mark Twain once said that everything under God is comprehensible by man. And then he paused and he said, except perhaps copyright law. And I'll end with that.
Wonderful. Okay, so our third speaker, Matt Pearl, the youngest of the group here, just starting out in what looks to be a skyrocketing artistic career. So he went to Harvard, went to Yale Law School, and has been thinking about, in some extent writing about, ideas of creativity since then. But much more important than his scholarly studies, at least for visibility and probably for our purposes here, is his novel, The Dante Club, came out recently and has been selling wildly. It's principal relevance to the themes of the conference is that it draws upon mixtures of fact fiction and facts about fiction in Dante's work and the scholarly reception of Dante's work. So I'd invite Matt, either from the standpoint of your own experiences as a creator in the literary analog to the primarily musical issues we've been discussing thus far, or as a student of these themes, to see which, if any, of the propositions introduced by Bill and Paul seem resonant, or would you agree, would you disagree? How would you extend their thoughts?
Well, let me just say thank you for having me. This is a bit of a different type of event than I usually do when talking about either my book or writing in general. I guess it was interesting to hear that dilemma of whether you pursue this claim or lack of claim on your property with the song that may or may not use your publishing. And I guess I'm one of the things I'm most interested in this realm is that are those gray areas where it's not clear and almost you have to invent or fabricate or approximate what the law is or what your stand is. It reminds me of I think when the Honeymooners was still, well, I don't know if it was still on, but when the Flintstones was created, which we all know is the Honeymooners, except changing the names to Fred and Barney and Wilma and Betty. And Jackie Gleason was going to sue, and he probably would have won. And his lawyer said to him, "Do you really want to be known as the man who killed Fred Flintstone?" And he didn't, and he chose not to. So I think one of the things that interests me is there are these extra legal motivations and impulses and incentives beyond what is actually in the law, and those confusing areas, which definitely is throughout literature and the way we write and the way books communicate with other books. I was interested to hear Eric and Mike talking about decoding songs and the idea of it as a game. It reminds me of T.S. Eliot. Also, Bill's title of his book, To Steal a Book is an Elegant Offense, is sort of rephrased by T.S. Eliot in his famous phrase, good artists borrow, great artists steal. And I think Eliot was definitely aware of the way in which reading is a game. One of the sections of The Wasteland, his major poem that incorporates literature and poetry from, you know, 300 centuries, three centuries, is one section is called A Game of Chess. And I think he knows that that's what we're playing when we're dealing with this interconnected network of illusions and overlaps. I mean, to the point where Eliot actually, his entire poem is filled with footnotes, and it's a very different poetry reading experience when you're stopping for footnotes. And some of the footnotes are just wildly unhelpful. And I think Eliot is also playing a game with the idea that we're playing a game, and knows that when we look at the footnote, we're going to have, especially when it's in Greek, I mean, the footnote will be in Greek, that it's we have no idea where we're going. So I think there's often this static electricity between the legal side of it, the technical side of it, and the creative side of it. I'm often asked the question, as a novelist, why did you go to law? Well, it sort of varies in form, but the question is presented either as why did you go to law school, or how did you write a book while in law school? I wrote the first draft of my novel when I was at Yale for law school. Or do you use your law degree at all as a novelist? So these sort of an interest in that zone in which the creative and the legal mix or don't mix. I mean, one thing that I'll always remember is the first week of law school at Yale, a professor who I won't name, standing up in front of our whole class and telling us that when we're finished learning how to write like a lawyer, when we're finished sort of becoming experts at legal writing, we will never be able to write creatively again. And with a completely straight face, and not as a negative comment, I sort of gasped at this and looked around and thought everyone else would be gasping, but they're sort of just nodding, okay? Maybe they were gasping on the inside. And I think that actually provoked me in part to make sure that I could write creatively. And the gentleman, the professor, is very nice man. I don't think he meant it in any malicious way, and maybe even hadn't thought through the ramifications. And I think he's wrong. But it's that uncomfortable or uncertain mix of those two things. I had an idea for a paper, because I did specialize, to the extent that you specialize in something at Yale, in intellectual property issues of this type. And I wanted to write one of my big papers. You have two big papers at Yale, the substantial and the SAW. No one knows what either of those things mean. And I had, for one of them, I can't remember which, I wanted to write about, at the time, because it was before the new copyright law passed, I wanted to write a paper on the strategies that Disney was preparing to overprotect Mickey Mouse, to protect him beyond when his copyright ran out. And they really were gearing up for this. They had a whole battle plan laid out to replace copyright with trademark. And if you think about it, trademark never expires. Trademark protects something that represents the identity of a company. And Mickey Mouse, besides being a character, besides being copyrighted, is also trademarked because he's their corporate logo. So they were sort of leading up to the point when the copyright would expire and they would replace this. So I went to a professor at the law school who specializes in intellectual property, who also remained nameless. And told him I wanted to write this paper, and I was told it wasn't a serious enough topic because it was Mickey Mouse, I guess, involved. So there's, I think, that disconnect or that uncertainty about things that are artistic and entertainment blending with the legal and how we do that can throw people off, I think. So yeah, I'm excited to hear what everyone says. I think I'll just add for now that when people do ask me whether I ever use my legal degree, I guess I'm sort of using it today. But I sort of use it. I read my contracts with my different publishers, and I can understand some of what it says. But also, I did use it actually at one instance very concretely, which is when they sent me The Galleys to my novel, which is a historical novel which uses this group of historical figures. The proofs, the galleys on the copyright page, had the copyright that said your standard copyright. Everything in this work is a work of fiction, and any resemblance to any person's living or dead is purely coincidental, et cetera, et cetera. And I called Random House and I said, well, no, it's not coincidental. It's very deliberate. I hope they resemble people who are dead. That's part of the point. And they said, well, you went to law school. You write the copyright. So I actually rewrote my copyright, and it's been used in other books, I think, and also been translated. When my book is translated, they've also translated the copyright. So it made me think, though, why they did that, if they had a reason, they might not have. But I think there's a tendency just to not want to deal with any of these issues, just to say this isn't a mixture of anything, it's just fiction. It's easier, it's safer, it's a way of overprotecting or underprotecting, I'm not sure which, but we sort of are afraid to confront that space that mixes these up in new ways.
So our last speaker continues in the chain of folks with extraordinarily rich qualifications crossing disciplinary boundaries. Lawrence Ferreira is currently chairman of the Department of Music and Performing Arts at NYU, drawing upon his experience as creator and scholar. So as creator, he is a pianist and a music theorist. As scholar, he's written Philosophy and the Analysis of Music, Bridges to Sound, Form, and Reference, Keyboard Harmony and Improvisation, and a Guide to Research in Music Education. He's also served as a consultant to, I guess, what we're starting to emerge in the mood of the room as it's the bad guys, the major intermediaries, the major record companies on a lot of copyright-related. So one of the things that threads that has emerged in each of the three presentations already is the legal system. Is the legal system helpful or hurtful in this environment? And we've got, from our different speakers, several ideas on the table. So one of them would be, first, it's a mistake to think of the legal system as too firm or sharp-edged and clear. It often has ambiguities, open spaces, requiring creativity on the part of advisors and struggle on the part of people who want to push it one direction or another. You know, so Wendy's comment earlier about this was the EFS is doing. It's trying to push it. So it's vague. Right, that's one theme. Another theme is that there's often, to the extent that it has clarity, often people affected by it deviate from its standards. And so it appears that many of the intermediaries, when they seek to abide by the law, treat it as more restrictive than it is in fact. So Paul's Second examples of this type, they list every conceivable sample in the Warner Brothers contractors of this type. The blanket disclaimer in books is of this type. The refusal of most publishers to allow biographers to quote more than little snippets. So a gap between whatever the law is and practice is another theme. And the last of the three themes is, is it sufficiently adaptable to handle our new world, our changing technology and creativity? So some of Paul's examples might earlier on suggested, see if I get this right, yes, it's sufficiently adaptable, that we've got this idea there are building blocks of the culture. Boy meets girl sequences. Everybody has to draw upon those, and the copyright system acknowledges that, says their idea is unprotectable. But when you get down to a really detailed version, like the tune of Leonard Bernstein's songs giving expression to this common theme, well, that's protected. That's our own. That's proprietary. So, yeah, those basic ideas were sensible in the past, and they're sensible now, too. Okay, those are sort of propositions that have been tossed out variously. So what are your thoughts on this score?
Okay. Thanks very much, Terry. It's a great pleasure to be here with you. Terry did, just before we commenced, suggest that perhaps I bring my comments to some of the trials and motions for summary judgment that I've been involved with, and some perhaps not. And so I was prepared, actually, initially to talk about the dialectic of inevitability and inventiveness and how it bears upon creativity, but we'll pass on that and bring it down to some areas that perhaps you'd find of more interest. The music industry, certainly under the law, clearly establishes that there is a bifurcation between the sound recording, that is the master, and the underlying composition. Certainly in the law, writings of Judge Learned Hand make that bifurcation very clear. And as a result of that, in the music industry and under the law, essentially we require two licenses. That is, sometimes a license for the sound recording, sometimes a license for the underlying composition, and sometimes both. And just so we can understand very briefly, the standard, if you will, for what is called substantial similarity for the underlying composition, and how a defendant, in some cases, in many cases, the bad guy, is going to fend off a plaintiff's claim. Substantial similarity, of course, first requires a valid copyright, and that's usually just being able to provide evidence that you have a deposit copy with the Copyright Office. Easy enough. And there are other ways to memorialize your copyright without going to the Copyright Office. But in addition to that, substantial similarity in music requires that the similarities are significant, and that the significance of those similarities is therefore probative of copying. And that suggested copying, of course, would mitigate the defendant's claim to independent creation. The last piece of this, though, is very important, and that is that these significant similarities that are probative of copying represent original expression. And original expression is a term that is as musicological as it is legal. Protected expression, of course, is a legal term, but musicologists use the word original and expression and so forth. And so essentially, that is the standard, if you will, to be successful in a claim of music copyright infringement for the underlying composition. In response to that, a defendant can bring forth evidence that the similarities are de minimis. That is, that the similarities, particularly in the allegedly infringed work, are minimal. They could be both qualitatively or quantitatively minimal. In addition, another usual defense is that even if the similarities are significant, even if they are significant to the original and to the allegedly infringing work, those similarities represent commonplace practices. Probably in the next 3 or 4 months, I may be part of a trial on behalf of Eminem, Dr. Dre, and Universal in a litigation, and already established in our paper, so there's no confidentiality problem here, is that we have made that case. And that is that the second case, and that is that the similarities between these two works, which agreeably on the surface seem significant, represent commonplace practices. They represent, in this case, melodies, harmonies, and so forth, rhythms that have been used for centuries. Essentially, then, the underlying music composition is a matter of interpolation. That is, someone comes along and reperforms or interpolates, as you heard earlier on the guitar. On the other hand, in the master or sound recording, we talk about a sample where you, in a sense, electronically make a copy of some portion of the original work, and you use it in the second work. Now, one thing that we want to keep in mind, and this goes to the issue of the Warner master use and your underlying composition. If the sample at issue represents, in terms of its underlying music, substantial similarity to the work that sampled it, then you have to pay for a second license. That is, sometimes a sample can be 2 measures of music or 4 measures of music. And when that is the case, you have to pay for a second license, the underlying composition. At other times, it is not the case. And by way of example, this coming Monday, I've been asked to sit in on a mediation between two parties. I'm working on behalf of a major record company, and there are 4 sampling issues. And in fact, one of them happens to be a sample of a snare drum and a shaker, and it is literally about 1.5 seconds long. It is essentially the second and the fourth beat in the second song throughout the song. It's part of the underlying music. Now, the question that came up several times in terms of fair use is, does this major record company, whose record clearly sampled this snare and shaker sound from a 1970s funk song, does it need to pay a licensing fee on the sound recording? In my opinion, it does. In my opinion, and as I have looked at the prior judgments, with one exception that I want to talk about, essentially whatever you sample, you have to pay for. And depending on the qualitative and quantitative importance of that sample, you will usually be able to work out some kind of a licensing percentage, or in some cases, just a straight payoff. By way of example, a very well-known Newton V. Diamond out in L.A., and I was working on behalf of Beastie Boys, Michael Diamond et al., the original sample at issue was this 6-second sample from James Newton's work. The defendants properly and duly licensed that sample from a German company, a German record company, and I think paid about $1,000 for that with no further royalties. James Newton, on the other hand, came forward and said, no, the underlying music represented original expression and therefore a second license was necessary. We disagreed, and of course we were granted a motion for summary judgment, which was upheld by the appellate court and then by the full appellate court of 11 judges thereafter. Let's think about a couple of things. First, earlier it was suggested that in producers like Timberland, it can be very difficult to essentially excavate what is there in an overall mix, and that's very true. Some of the sampling cases I've done have been cases where the original sample is what we call chopped up. You take the first beat and you put it around and so forth. Just as you can isolate and you can isolate through Pro Tools any of the sounds and chop them up, and then you can compress them, EQ them, and so forth, making it very, very difficult to excavate whether or not it was actually sampled. But in fact, in many cases, we are able through discovery to acquire the original Pro Tools. And in fact, I did a case on behalf of Linkin Park, and the Pro Tools were proffered. And in Pro Tools, you can actually separate track by track, and with a good deal of accuracy and scientific objectivity, you can say, oh no, this is definitely a sample. Yes, in the final commercial mix, you can't tell. But once Pro Tools is uncovered and excavated, it's very difficult to steal. And so, in fact, I do a lot of clearance, not only for underlying composition, but for sampling, for motion picture companies, record companies, and so forth. And they're all very, very cognizant of the fact that you've got to license everything. I just wanted to speak very briefly about one recent case that that Terry knows about and mentioned that many of you will know about. I was not involved in it. It was in Nashville. It was Bridgeport v. Dimension Films. And Bridgeport, as you know, is a record company that hasn't produced a lot of records, but throughout the 80s and 90s, particularly the 80s, essentially bought up thousands of copyrights of funk songs and so forth, what we would consider now 3 cents on the dollar. And several years ago, in federal court in Nashville, put out over 400 claims on copyright infringement based mostly on the sound recording. Warner alone had, and its affiliates, had over 100 claims, and BMG something like 60, and Bad Boy Records, Sean Combs' company, about 8 and so forth, and I have consulted with all of those companies on many of those issues. Higgins, in October of 2002, granted the defendants, Dimension Films, a motion for summary judgment. It was very interesting. Essentially, the sample at issue, it was not an underlying composition issue, it was a sampling issue. The sample was a three-note riff in a guitar that was no more than breaking up a chord. You simply strum a guitar strings and you get a chord. Well, this was simply an arpeggiation of that chord. One of the most commonplace and trite compositional devices in all of music, but once again, the underlying composition was not at issue. It was this sound recording, and there was no question that the sound recording in the original Bridgeport song was sampled. What is extraordinary is that Judge Higgins granted defendants a motion for summary judgment on the basis of de minimis similarities. That is, that he suggested that this three-note passage was so qualitatively and quantitatively minimal in importance to the original work that defendants had every right to the fair use thereof. The problem with that is that Judge Higgins has conflated the standard for substantial similarity in the underlying composition. And by that standard, clearly there would be no infringement, with the standard for the licensing of a sound recording. And up until that point, essentially, even if you sampled a snare drum, you paid a licensing fee. Okay.
Let's get some of the audience involved. Yeah. So we need a microphone. You may have to turn it on.
Testing?
Okay.
I have a question for you.
Tell us who you are.
My name is Adam Morris. I'm the publishing technology programmer analyst for Harvard University Press. I've been interested in issues of copyright and digital issues for a while now. You've been talking about sampling. You're very clear that a sample is a sample is a sample. But I mean, at a certain point, what a recording is, particularly a digital recording, is the digital approximation of a sound wave. And it is possible to alter this sound wave to such an extent that it is vastly different than the original sound wave. Is there any point at which a sample is altered, so altered that it is no longer the same thing? At what point does a sample not become a sample? Can that ever happen? If you've completely changed it, so now a snare drum sounds like a bird whistling. Have I sampled the snare drum?
Well, a couple of things. First, if it was changed that dramatically, it would not be picked up. That is, it would be inaudible, and so not a problem. Generally, there is some likeness, even with things that have been chopped up and deeply compressed or EQ'd and so forth.
Although your intriguing example of the Pro Tools discovery,
yes,
suggests that those would be rooted out in, say, in the course of the litigation directed initially at something else.
Indeed, but what would prompt this, the catalyst for such a claim, would be that in this continuum from a sample that is literally the same thing and nothing has been done to it, to a sample that has been so changed that no one, even an expert, listening to the final mix could pick it up, that somewhere in between that someone has picked it up, then indeed the Pro Tools would uncover that. Record companies, for the most part, are taking a very conservative view of this, and no matter what has been done, if they know that it is indeed a sample, as we learned earlier, in the contract they require that they're told by the producer. And in addition, they will attempt to get a copyright license. And if denied, then either that track from the Pro Tools will be omitted or the entire song will be taken off the album.
Thank you.
Gentleman back here.
Hi, my name is Michael Harrington. I live, teach, and work in Nashville, Tennessee. And Bridgeport approached me and asked me to be the expert witness in their 476 cases. So I know this thing pretty well. I had to turn them down based on a bunch of reasons, some you could probably imagine. But when it came to that case, I just found it preposterous. I've played this for years for my students. I'm glad I turned it down so I could talk about it constantly. And the song is 100 Miles and Running by NWA. No one has ever heard the sample. I mean, I think what Judge Higgins said was right. It was didn't rise to, it wasn't legally cognizable as a sample. I think it gets to the point where if it's that much of nitpicking and analyzing and dissecting with Pro Tools or a microscope or however you want to do it, when it gets that crazy, I mean, I think it's going to get out of hand. For instance, what if I sample Sting's Rain in his Rainstorm and Fortress Around Your Heart and the Doors in Riders on the Storm? And alter the Rain. I mean, or the rooster at Good Morning on Sgt. Pepper. Do I have to record my own rooster? If I live in a city and can't find a rooster, could I use the Beatles' rooster? I think what this has led to, I mean, even the RIAA, who I always seem to disagree with, even they have come out and said that decision is bad. It's in the Sixth Circuit. We, the side I like, lost, and it's been appealed, and it's going to go to the Supreme Court probably,
yes.
At least everyone wants it to. Mm-hmm. Because it's just, I think it's such a bad decision. It's just affected everyone, and it's frightened everyone. It also takes away any idea of de minimis and transformative use. I don't know what you think of that particular one or where you think it might go from here. I guess that could be my question.
Well,
I'm preaching here.
Yeah, I agree that the Higgins decision, at least from my standpoint, seems to be muddle-headed. I think the basis of that disagreement is that there's a conflation here between two standards, substantial similarity for the underlying composition and a sampling infringement. On the other hand, there is a common sense approach, and that would be that there should be some kind of fair use of sampling. I think that somewhere between the most conservative approach that a lot of record companies are taking and Higgins' decision, there's probably going to be a place for the law to posit itself so that someone can take some minimal sound and not have to require taking a sound recording license on it.
Bill, I want to come back to you for just a second. If we, Paul, in his presentation, suggested that there was early in human history or human creative history the emergence of what seems to be a natural impulse of proprietary control, but that initially it's predominantly what lawyers would call a right of attribution, a right to be given credit, it's mine, and then only later acquires a commercial adjunct that it becomes associated with the right to charge money for other to other people. And in the Bridgeport Music case, we see in the Sixth Circuit's ruling anyway, what one might regard as the terminus of this trend, in which you now have not just the right to charge when a significant portion is taken, but a right to charge when an arpeggiated chord is lifted and modified sufficiently, you can't even hear it. Now, turning all the way back to Chinese culture with which you're familiar, presumably the terminus of this trend and the penetration of the industry with commercial relations that the legal system in the United States seems to be drifting toward is a long way from certainly not just ancient Chinese culture, but contemporary Chinese culture. So the question is, how far back on this spectrum does one have to go in order to locate something durable and cross-cultural? So, for example, if we get back to attribution, one signal on this front might be taken from Creative Commons and its practices of allowing people to pick a variety of entitlements that they want to use. Turns out that most of them give up the right to charge money. What they don't give up is attribution. It's mine. So on that level, is it your sense that by studying ancient Chinese culture, or your sense of what's happening now, that that one is truly cross-cultural, human nature grounded, whereas some of this other stuff may be way out in the zone of culture specific?
Yeah, I mean, I was struck earlier, like in Mike Dowdy's comments, that certain kinds of things he wouldn't be worried about commercially, but would want to receive the sort of acknowledgement of the world or credit or keep the integrity of one's work. I'd be interested to engage Paul in this part of the conversation. Yeah, I think that some of that dimension is cross-cultural. I mean, clearly you can see in China now the big battle of the commercial side of it as opposed to the acknowledgement side being fought out sort of right in our eyes, in a sense maybe comparable to struggles in a less pronounced form that might have occurred in the West 200 or 300 years ago.
But fought out half-heartedly, right? I mean, the government's not really enthusiastic about carrying forward what initially began with gunboat diplomacy.
Yeah, I mean, certainly this, the idea of sort of absorbing the law, learning the law at gunpoint, I think it's a chapter title I used in one of these things, remains a real problem. Yeah, I mean, the Chinese, it's not in the creative arts vehicle, but General Motors has had this huge problem in China where one of their cars is like completely backward engineered in China down to the last detail, and then Chinese cars made from that. And it became a huge problem for General Motors because these things would break down if you drove over more than 30 miles an hour. Right. And it turned out when they sought legal redress, because somebody in the Central Committee, Standing Committee of the Central Committee of the Chinese Communist Party had an ownership interest in this factory, they couldn't do anything legally, really suggests, as you're saying, a lack of government commitment. But I think the more interesting thing, actually, Terry, is the, you know, you see people in China now who have, after years of Communist Party sort of keeping a lid on certain kinds of creative activity for political reasons, now being exuberant in creation and beginning, for reasons of attribution and perhaps a little bit commercially as well, wanting to get more acknowledgement, more credit, more protection, coming against the traditional attitudes. Mm-hmm. And then in a different way, foreign companies with the kind of interests that Lawrence is talking about also interplay. So it's there now. It's all being played out in live time.
All right. I think we should stop. Thanks so much to our panelists, and we'll carry on with the rest of the day.